Welcome to This Is Money podcast, sponsored by Charles Stanley Direct. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and Simon Lambert today is Helen Crane. And coming up, interest rates cut to 4.5%. Where will they head next? And what does it mean for your mortgage and savings? Are we seeing central bank divergence between the UK, US and Europe on the direction of travel for rates? What could Trump's trade war mean for your investments? And does it open up opportunities elsewhere? Plus, investing lessons from the pandemic crash and rebound, the unusual mortgage payment trick that could clear debt 5 years earlier, and finally, Nectar is doing something about their stolen points problem. Don't forget to stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Take control of your finances with Charles Stanley Direct. Invest, save, coach or plan. Using technology where it's helpful and people where it matters. Our website and app make trading cost-effective and flexible. But we're more than just an online investment service. We're here for you regardless of your financial needs or if your life takes an unexpected turn. Your finances, your way. Take control today with Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.
But first, as expected, the Bank of England cut rates by 25 basis points to 4.5%, to 20-month low, with two members of the MPC backing an even bigger cut. Traders are now betting on more reductions through this year, but the bank has also piled more pressure on the Chancellor by slashing growth forecasts for 2025 in half. So what does it all mean for our money? Simon, Helen, welcome. Simon, what happened? Why did it happen?
Well, as you said there, Georgie, it was a 7-2 vote to cut rates. And there was actually members who wanted to cut by more. The rate cut was pretty much nailed on. Everyone was saying it's definitely going to be a rate cut today. And one of the reasons for that was given as if they didn't cut today, they couldn't space them out nicely through the year. However, the Bank of England has indicated that it sees inflation going up, but temporarily. It says we expect inflation to rise temporarily this year to 3.7%, including reasons that are a multitude, but it said largely because of higher energy prices. That was the thing it named. Inflation is expected to fall back again to the 2% target after that. So what the bank is saying is we're going to look through this energy price spike that is going to send inflation up to almost double the target. And we're happy enough to do that, that we're going to cut rates today. Mm-hmm. It's also, as you said, downgraded expectations for growth. By lowering growth expectations, it doesn't do Rachel Reeves any favours. No. But what it does do is says we're not going to expect more inflation from there. We're not going to necessarily expect more inflation from wages, which is something that the Bank of England is looking at quite closely, because wages have been coming in with higher wage inflation than it was thought we would be at this point. And it's saying we think, you know, we can cut rates in the face of this. And actually that lowering of growth expectations indicates maybe we might get more rate cuts than we thought this year. So that's the big picture on rates from the Bank of England.
Are we going to go into recession, Simon?
Well, I mean, who knows? A recession is two consecutive quarters of negative growth or two consecutive quarters of GDP shrinking. We don't know. The Bank of England has said GDP growth has been weaker than expected at the time of the November monetary policy report, and indicators of business and consumer confidence have declined. GDP growth is expected to pick up from the middle of this year. The labour market has continued to ease and is judged to be broadly in balance. Productivity growth has been weaker than previously estimated, and the committee judges that the growth in the supply capacity of the economy has weakened. As a result, the recent slowdown in demand is judged to have led to only a small margin of slack opening up. That's not the verdict on the economy that Rachel Reeves will have been looking for, having been elected on a mandate of growth. And I think, you know, without going down the political route, because let's face it, the Tories didn't do an amazing job of growth over the last 14 years that they were in charge either. But the Labour Party were elected on this, you know, we're going to deliver growth, we're going to deliver stability. The growth is an issue. And I think perhaps the problem that they still face, even after rolling out their growth plan the other week, you know, airport runways, Oxford to Cambridge rail links, all that kind of stuff, is there's still a lot of that stuff that isn't going to happen for years. I mean, you know, even with the 1.5 million houses that they're going to build, apparently, it takes a long time to build those houses. You know, shaking up the planning system, you know, whether that's needed or not, I don't know. I mean, my personal concern is that we appear to be riding roughshod over the environment here. And I think we need to be protecting the environment and the country that we live in at the same time as trying to deliver growth. And I'm not sure that we're striking the right balance on this. But, you know, it takes a long time to get those houses built, to shake up the planning system and everything like that. What the Labour Party need, and possibly what they are going to regret now not coming to power with, is stuff that was going to get growth moving right away. And I think that that's the most important thing for Rachel Reeves and Keir Starmer and the other members of the government to be thinking about right now is, okay, it's great we've got these grand plans for fixing Britain in the future, but what are we going to do to improve things now and get growth going now? And they needed to have arrived in power with some stuff that they could do right away. And if I was them, I'd be getting my brightest minds to think not about, you know, big, endless, long papers on this and papers on that, and what can we do, and runways that we're going to spend 10 years arguing about. I'd be thinking about, right, what could we do between now and the end of the year? What could we actually start doing between now and the end of the year that when we start doing it, money goes into the economy, into people's pockets, into the people doing it, and then starts getting that, you know, virtuous circle. I'll tell you how to get a bit of growth going. Fix the potholes. People that you pay to fix the roads have a habit of spending the money that you pay them, and it improves the roads and it improves something. It gives people something noticeable that they can see. You know, start fixing the roads. There you go. That's one idea for free. Anybody can take that one.
All right, we'll see if that happens then, Simon. Just a quick one before I move on to how this affects mortgages and savings. You mentioned there about house building. House building, house builder shares up on the news of interest rates. Anything else does well in this environment, Simon?
It's generally bad for banks, but you're looking at a scenario now where interest rates are running at a higher level than they were for many years. And that's just good for banks, full stop, if you compare it to when rates were at 0.5%. But you have seen in the bank's results that they're not making quite as much money on the net interest margins. It's good for businesses overall because it means that they can borrow at a lower rate. In theory, it's good for businesses that want to invest. The problem is you've got lots of businesses who are very reluctant to invest at the moment because they're looking at a fairly gloomy sentiment, potentially, you know, self-inflicted. And the other kind of businesses it would be good for is kind of consumer businesses because you're basically putting more money in people's pockets. And actually, you know, if you can put more money in people's pockets through them not having their mortgages go up by as much or reducing the cost of the borrowing that they're doing, you know, that is the entire idea behind cutting rates is to make borrowing cheaper and it encourages more people to borrow. Then in theory, that is good, you know, for consumer businesses. And also taking a little bit of the worry off people's plates is potentially good for people's personal finances and how they feel about it as well. And actually, I think that's another area where, yeah, I think there's actually probably a short-term fix that could be done, which is sorting out some of the mess in the tax system as well. But I won't go into that because actually lots of there's this scenario where, as I've said before, we've got a cottage industry in this country of people, quite high earning people at you know, different levels through the system. There's a cottage industry in trying to earn less money so you don't get caught out by tax traps and you find people saving more money and so on. And actually, what we need to do is get all the pensioners and the boomers spending their money, which maybe the inheritance tax changes are going to do that, the pulling pensions into inheritance tax. But we need to get people out of this bunker mentality where they're, you know, this the paradox of thrift. They're constantly trying to save money because they're worried about what's coming ahead of them, when actually some of them have got plenty of cash and could do with spending some of it.
Yes, Helen, Simon mentioned mortgages there. anyone who has a mortgage might be thinking, hoping for rates to go down. Is that likely? Let's start there, Helen. Mortgages.
So when the base rate falls, it's generally good news for anyone with a mortgage, particularly anyone who needs to take out a new mortgage at any point soon. Although the effects never happen immediately, we always say this, it's not as if the base rate gets cut and banks immediately start slashing their rates in response. They tend to look at the picture sort of slightly further ahead. So today's rates are based on where banks think interest rates will be, months, years down the line. Obviously, most fixed mortgages are 2 years or 5 years. So when they're deciding their rates, they're looking at where interest rates might be at that point. However, we have seen some rate cuts recently. So just this week, we've had a handful of banks bringing rates down. Halifax, HSBC, Clydesdale, Barclays, Coventry have all brought their rates down a little bit. So I think we are in an environment where banks are seeing that, rates are on the way down. As Simon said, perhaps two or three more rates cuts throughout this year. So they're moving in the right direction. So if we look at where rates are at the moment, the lowest 5 year fix, this is for someone with the biggest amount of money to put down, so 40%, is 4.13%. That's with First Direct. 2 year fix is still a bit more pricey. The cheapest rate, again, for people with a big deposit is 4.23%. So, things are coming down. As I think I say quite often, we're not going to get back to those sort of 1-2% rates anytime soon, but they are gradually coming down. The other thing to say is as well, much better news, a base rate cut for anyone who has a mortgage that's directly linked to the base rate, for example, a tracker, they will see an immediate fall in their payments. So yeah, generally pretty good news.
Simon?
I think there's an interesting thing going on in the mortgage market at the moment where basically there was this big shift up in expectations of what might happen to interest rates this year, pre-Christmas kind of time. It was kind of more like a December thing, right? Some of that was related to the US election. And so we saw rates going up, but now there's been a shift back in that, and there's the expectation that actually things aren't going to be as bad as, and rates probably come down a bit more. And after this, there's probably going to be a bit more of an expectation of that. But actually, when you look at the Bank of England's report, the expectations for rates this year are now higher than they were the last time round that they did a monetary policy report in November. So, now the expectation is that at the start of next year, base rate will be 4.2%. Whereas in November, the expectation was that it would be 3.7%. There's quite a big difference between those two. That's, half a percentage point. But actually, those numbers in the report are probably totally out of date because the market interest rate expectations have sort of shifted. And I think you're going to see off the back of that we're probably going to go back more towards where we were in November rather than sticking with the numbers that they've put in that report. And that will influence what happens with your mortgage. I mean, I'm hoping it does because my mortgage is up for renewal in September. So yeah, if we could like have massively heightened interest rate cut expectations that sends mortgage rates absolutely tumbling between now and September, I would be extremely grateful.
All right then. Good to know, Simon. Good to know. But it does highlight the point that if you are thinking of remortgaging, are you thinking 2 years? Are you thinking 5 years?
I think it's still a tough one. More people are going for 2 year fixes. That's why they're a bit more expensive. It does seem likely that rates are going to be going down for the next couple of years. But then again, you
Who
never know.
knows?
Look at the last few years, Brexit, COVID, all these things have affected mortgage rates, and it just shows, things kind of, the mini budget, things can kind of spike. I think people are tending to opt for a 2 year because they think that in 2 years' time they'll be able to remortgage to something cheaper. But I don't think it will be drastically, hugely cheaper. I think it's very unlikely that in 2 years' time someone could remortgage and get a rate of less than 1% like we were a few years ago. So there's a value in stability as well with a 5 year fix. If you can find a 5 year fix that's a monthly payment you're happy with, you're comfortable that you want to stay in your current home for 5 years, it will be a bit cheaper on your monthly payments now. Maybe that's helpful if you've just moved. It's quite an expensive time. So It's certainly not a bad idea to take a 5-year fix if that fits your circumstances right now. I think it's just one of those where you've got to make a call about what's right for you. Speak to a broker as well, because they'll probably have some good advice, and just, have a careful think about it and what your circumstances are, and sort of make a judgment really.
So that's mortgages. Savings, Helen, I doubt it would be as good news for that.
No, not great news for savers. As it always is, when the base rate goes down, savings rates tend to go down as well. We did see the last time the base rate went down in December, banks moved to cut rates quite quickly, and it's anticipated that that will be happening again. So do keep an eye on your accounts and what your provider might be doing with your saving rates, because it's quite likely in the next sort of days and weeks that they are probably going to go down. So since this time last year, the average easy access rate has gone down from 3.17% to 2.92% today. But you can still get really decent rates. Coventry Building Society launched a easy access account with 4.85% rate, which is really decent. So there are still, if you're willing to shop around, look at our Best Buy tables on the This Is Money website, there are still some really decent accounts that you can get. Looking at fixed rates as well, best 1-year fix, 4.19%. That's obviously less than easy access, but that's with the expectation that someone fixing at 4.19% today, maybe in a year's time, easy access accounts will have gone lower and they'll still be fixed at that higher rate. So it is kind of only going one way for savers as the base rate goes down. But given that a few years ago savings rates were down at, 1-2%, even the best rates, it's still worth shopping around and finding a good account, and there's still good deals to be had if you know where to look.
Which is signing up for your savings alerts as well.
Come to thisismoney.co.uk/savings and sign up to our savings alerts, and you will find out about all the best rates as soon as they land and we decide that they are worth writing about and telling you about. And that means that you can join in the current tussle that is going on at the top of the cash ISA rates table, where brilliantly we've got a handful of providers fighting to give people the best rates. And at one point, over the last couple of weeks, rates have just gone up day after day after day, which is great for
Which
savers.
is great, which is great. I want to go global now, but before we get to the trade wars, which everybody's talking about, unsurprisingly, I want to look a little bit more about central banks and rates, because with the US more focus, it seems, on lowering yields than rates, and suggestions the ECB may need to reduce rates below neutral levels to stimulate growth. Are we seeing divergence, Simon Lambert, on rates between the US, UK, and Europe? And what does it matter if we are?
We are. We certainly are. And we are, interestingly, somewhat in the middle of this. So the Fed funds rate was held in its January meeting at the 4.25 to 4.5% range. They go for this range idea, right? We're now at 4.5%. So we're broadly level with the US. However, there are some questions as to whether the US is going to keep cutting. And there's even people raising the prospects of maybe they might even need to raise interest rates. Now, they're obviously watching what's going to happen as Donald Trump's policies get rolled out and put in place. And whether that is going to cause the US economy, which is doing much, much better than the UK economy or the Eurozone economy as a whole, or the most of the countries within the Eurozone economy as well, whether that's at the point of overheating and whether actually Donald Trump's policies are inflationary and will trigger the US economy to overheat more. And so therefore, do they need to cut rates again at all? Do they need to raise rates? The Fed's, very much wait and see mode. The UK, as we explained, we are struggling for growth. The Bank of England has said that we may only narrowly avoid recession. And in the MPC indicated today that it thinks there's, plenty of room for cutting rates. Okay, so we're going to probably see some more cuts, but it's highly unlikely we'll see aggressive cuts, I think, particularly with the fact that inflation is going to go up, according to the bank. Now, the ECB, on the other hand, has made five interest rate cuts, and its benchmark rate is only at 2.75%. And there is this suggestion that it's going to need to keep going perhaps to somewhere between 1.75 and 2.25%. So the lower end of that is really quite low interest rates, particularly if you see the Bank of England only cut another couple of times this year and the Fed stick where it is. And that makes rate policy quite interesting at the moment because over the last kind of decade and a bit, we've tended to all move in the same direction. The numbers may not be the same, the timing may not be exactly the same, but the direction is the same, with a few outlying moments for the ECB. But it's that direction that matters more for interest rates than the actual number, really. The number really does matter, but it's what's seen as going to happen in the future. And if we do see this divergence of our merry gang of three going off on three slightly different routes, it will make for more interesting times trying to work out what's going to happen and how it's going to impact things, particularly when you start taking into account stuff like currency movements. So for example, if the Fed sticks where it is and we keep cutting, then the pound is theoretically going to depreciate further against the dollar. But if the Fed sticks where it is and the ECB keeps cutting and cuts much more aggressively, then the euro is going to sink substantially against the dollar. That's going to make stuff made in Europe cheaper in America, which might encourage people to buy more of it. And Donald Trump doesn't want them to do that. And I mean, Donald Trump would very much like the Fed to start cutting interest rates aggressively. The Fed is definitely trying to stand its ground here. And so that would bring the dollar down. But yeah, you've got this problem where a strong dollar makes imports from other countries more expensive, and that will act in direct contradiction to Mr. Donald Trump's plans on tariffs.
Which, Simon, you've just beautifully teed me up like a Trump golf swing there to talk about tariffs, because he promised tariffs throughout his campaign. So we got them in the Trump 1.0. This should be no surprise that this is now what we've got. Well, we've got a couple of 1 month reprieves for 25% tariffs on Mexico and Canada. China, though, they got hit with 10% tariffs. In the firing line up next could be the EU. Will the UK be targeted? Who knows? And what does it all mean for our investments? Firstly, what are tariffs? Why is Trump so excited by them?
Tariffs are something that are placed on one country by another country in order to make it more expensive to buy things from that other country. So country A decides that country B is in some way gaining some form of unfair advantage by selling to it at a too cheap price. So country A says, right, from now on, we're going to artificially change that price. And when your goods come into our country, they're going to have a tariff put on them. And that means that for the consumers in our country, it's going to be more expensive to buy stuff from country B. And that means that they're going to be more likely to buy stuff that we make at home in country A.
So it's the companies in that country that have to pay. It's not like the
So
government.
yes, exactly. So it makes it more expensive to import those goods, discourages, companies from importing those goods because it drives up the cost to the consumer. But also, don't just think about the consumer here, think about producers as well, because it affects businesses. Businesses, buy in the raw materials that they use to make products. Basically, we drive up the cost. And then that theoretically that benefits the economy of country A because it means that, country A's stuff becomes more competitive versus country B. Country A in this U case is the USA. Country B is every single other country in the world. So it's countries B to Z and then some. Now, to give an example of this, the USA is not the only place indulging in tariffs. That bastion of free trade, the Eurozone, has also been doing a bit of this. Chinese electric cars. It is deemed to be that, China is subsidizing its electric car industry, delivering it an unfair advantage. That is to the detriment of Europe's car makers. Car making is a big and important thing in Europe. They need to be protected. And so you put on a tariff that makes those Chinese electric cars more expensive. Donald Trump I believe, has on occasion said that tariff is the most beautiful word in the English language or something there like. He is a big fan of them. And it was in his manifesto, mandate, whatever you want to call it. But there was this question as to whether he would actually impose these big tariffs or whether it would just be the threat of big tariffs. And I think there was maybe people got a bit, thinking in, actually, he's not probably not going to do these things. And he set the cat amongst the pigeons at the start of this week by actually imposing a load of whacking great tariffs on people, which, upset markets. Now, the problem is you don't know what's going to happen here. Best case scenario, the tariffs don't come in. Second base scenario, the tariffs come in, everything just adjusts, and people work out deals like they've been trying to work out at the start of the week, the Mexico deal and stuff like that. Next one down the line is like it's relatively contained. But actually, the worst case scenario is you start to get tit for tat tariffs. So, we're going to put charge a tariff on you. Fine. Well, we're going to charge a tariff on you. Well, I'm going to charge you another one back. And it just escalates. And the people who lose out in this are ultimately the consumers. And tariffs are judged in general economic theory to be bad. They distort markets, they cause problems, they hamper free trade, and that everyone loses out. It's treated often by those who are supporters of tariffs as, well, zero-sum game. We win, you lose. But in economic theory, it's just to be a bad thing and everyone loses. Just some
And
lose
the
more than others.
So could the UK be hit, I guess, is what we want to know. Helen, what do you reckon?
I think potentially, I mean, as Simon said, you kind of never know with Trump, do you? When he brought in these tariffs, I mean, he'd sort of always said that he was going to do something like this, but with the threats to Canada, it was like, well, this comes in at midnight tomorrow. Obviously, it actually didn't in the end, but it seems like it can kind of, in terms of the details, it can sort of turn on a sixpence. From what we've heard so far, it seems like there's been kind of conversations with Starmer, and it seems like we might kind of avoid it for now. Seems like that there's been chat, and the chat has been a relatively sort of positive. But I mean, who knows?
I mean,
Really, I don't know.
that's
It's
it. Who knows?
impossible to give an
It's
answer.
so unpredictable with all of these, this talk of tariffs. Will they happen? Won't they happen? This Macau in the Mediterranean with the Gaza Strip. I mean, for goodness sakes. Interestingly, though, Simon, with this tariffs, and I want to know how it will affect investment, but particularly with the EU. Yes, certainly there might be a deficit with goods, but certainly not with services. And I believe it was someone from the EU saying, think about all the pensions and the savings and our money that's flowing into American companies. Could that be affected?
Well, that's a good question because if you're Donald Trump, then your general belief is that the rest of the world is getting a free ride off America, and that needs to stop. He's talked about how we've got an internal revenue service. Well, we're going to start having an external revenue service where people start paying us what we're due. And as far as he's concerned, the rest of the world is getting a free ride. Now, you could argue that America is getting a pretty decent ride off the rest of the world as well. Because certainly if you look at the stock market, which is not the same as the economy, but the American stock market has been doing very well, and Donald Trump uses that as a pretty decent barometer of whether stuff is good or not. The American stock market makes up 74% of the global index on some, global index measures. And we just keep buying big US company shares. The top 10 companies in the S&P 500 make up about 40% of it, and nine of them are big tech, and seven of them are the Magnificent Seven. And they are benefiting hugely from the world buying their shares and driving up their share prices. Ultimately, whilst most of that money appears to just drift out into the pockets of some billionaires, there is a trickle-down effect somewhere. I mean, I guess Donald Trump would argue that America has also given the world, loads of social media for free. And then the world could say, yeah, but we're giving you all our data for free, and that's how you're making a load of money. So you could go round and round in circles here, couldn't you? But maybe everyone isn't getting quite the free ride that America thinks. And maybe you start will start to see a backlash against investing in American companies. You might start to see a backlash against buying American. I don't know whether you will do in this country, to be honest, but you, in places like China, for example, where you might get the more risk of this tit for tat stuff, and in places like Europe, where there's quite a strong anti-Europe rhetoric, what's going to happen to Tesla sales, for example? There's that marginal decision of should I buy a BMW, should I buy a Tesla? Probably going to be a lot more people going, I'll buy a BMW or I'll buy a Citroen. But actually, if you look at Germany and France, they've got quite a strong tradition of buying French, buying German, the way round that works. And in Europe, there is a bit of that kind of thing. So how different is that to the Buy American thing? How different is it to the Buy British thing? I mean, maybe every time we make a purchase or we interact with a business, we should think, can I buy something from a British business? Can I buy something that's made in Britain? Who's going to benefit from me making a decision, buying a good or a service? And is that economic benefit going to stay in this country, and equal, extra revenue in tax and extra economic activity in this country, or is it just going to drift out of the country? Maybe we should be thinking that. One thing about Trump, interestingly, is that he's a big fan of a former US president that does not have a name that trips off the tongue when asked to name famous US presidents, a guy called William McKinley. And Trump says that the tariffs that he imposed in 1890 made America prosperous and ushered in a golden age. This was when the US overtook Britain as the world's biggest economy. And he wants to repeat that formula, to make America great again. There are others pointing to times when tariffs were brought in particular, the 1930s when it caused chaos.
Indeed, indeed. Simon, I do want to know how this is going to affect investments, though. Where are the opportunities to be had? What should investors be looking at now in this sort of somewhat, how do we put it, volatile environment?
Okay, well, so basically the only trade in town for the last couple of years has been holding US stocks, the S&P 500, particularly the Magnificent Seven, and basically backing this idea of American exceptionalism. If you've invested against the US because you thought it was expensive, you've lost out. I hate to think how much money I would have made if I just bought an S&P 500 tracker rather than holding the selection of funds and investment trusts that I have that have been tilted away from America because I've been concerned that the American stock market is expensive. Well, it's continued to get more expensive, and the big companies in it have continued to make even more money. Okay, so I'm on the losing end of that trade at the moment. Right? I've not done as well as I could have done as an investor. But there does come a point where it does have to turn. The question is that point now? And if you look at some of those big, big businesses driving S&P 500 returns, the market returns as a whole, if you look at the Magnificent Seven, they potentially have the risk in place that they will in some way find their businesses disrupted or extra costs off the back of trade wars, ranging from Apple making stuff in China, Tesla selling cars in China, and so on and so on. If you look, though, elsewhere, there are parts of the American market that should benefit, and that tends to be more the medium and smaller companies in the US, which are seen as being more directly related to the US economy and more likely to benefit from increased spending in America and Trump's policies. You've got to be a bit careful with that, and some experts say don't buy the index because actually quite a lot of the companies in the Russell 2000 index in the US, which is the one that you could track with a cheap ETF, don't actually make that much money or are not profitable at all, and that actually you're better off going for an active fund or investment trust in this scenario where you've got a manager trying to pick the best companies for you. That depends if you're willing to continue to back the US. There is also the suggestion that maybe other places might benefit. Places where when people go, actually, do you know what? I'm a little bit worried that this, Magnificent Seven driven returns cannot continue forever. So I'm going to look somewhere else to put my money. Well, one place that is considered to potentially be a good opportunity is the UK, because our stock market is pretty cheap compared to the rest of the world. It's definitely cheap compared to America. And as we're recording this podcast, the FTSE 100 is hitting a new record high. False dawn, or can it continue? Will it be a great year for investing in the UK? I mean, as I said, the perennial thing
Say every year, don't
has been the US is expensive, the UK is cheap, you've got to
Yeah,
buy the
every
UK.
year.
And every year, if you've done that, you've made less money than if you just bought the US.
It for part one.
I'm joined now by Alex Webbone, Charles Stanley Direct, for our weekly Investing Explained feature. Alex, how much can I give away each year to try to cut my inheritance tax bill?
So in the UK, you can give away up to £3,000 each tax year as part of your annual exemption without it being added to the value of your estate for inheritance tax purposes. If you didn't use your allowance at all last year, you can carry it forward or carry forward the difference if you did give away less than the £3,000 limit. So in theory, you can give away up to £6,000 in the current tax year, or if, say, for example, you gave away £2,000 last tax year, you can add that on and give away £4,000 this year. In addition, you can make small gifts of up to £250 to as many people as you like each tax year. Any more than these amounts, though, could count as a potentially exempt transfer or a pet and form part of your estate if you were to die within 7 years of making the gift. There are also exemptions for wedding or civil partnership gifts, gifts to charities, and making regular gifts out of your income. So gifting from excess income can be a particularly effective method of inheritance tax mitigation planning. However, there are certain criteria to fulfill in order for it to count. At Charles Stanley Direct, we offer fixed fee inheritance tax plans. So do feel free to get in touch if you'd like to know more.
Alex, thank you very much.
Thank you, Simon.
Welcome back. With mortgage rates looking like they aren't going down fast anytime soon, I'm sorry, Simon, every little helps. Well, This Is Money can reveal an unusual mortgage payment trick that could clear your debt 5 years earlier. But not all lenders allow it, and it could cause an admin headache, says your reporter Ed Magnus. So Helen, what's this all about?
This is quite an interesting idea, and it's something I think has struck a chord a bit with our readers this week. It's not a new thing. It's something that people technically could always have done. But this broker Mojo has drawn attention to it. And I think it's something that most people wouldn't really think of. So the idea is that you could save tens of thousands of pounds on interest in your mortgage if, instead of paying your direct debit monthly, you paid it bi-weekly. So you make the same payment, but instead of making it once a month, you make it once every 2 weeks. So the way that this works is that because of the amount of weeks in the year, you would actually pay 26 half payments. So effectively, you would pay 13 full monthly mortgage payments over a year rather than 12 if you're paying monthly. So that could save you, on the average mortgage, £49,118 in interest across the life of the mortgage. So it's, you know, you are simply paying more, but the way it works, it's one of those things where you're almost kind of tricking yourself into paying more on your mortgage. And the fact that it's split up over these bi-weekly amounts would mean that for some people, maybe it wouldn't kind of feel like they're paying that much more, even though they are making that extra monthly payment. So, you know, a decent idea, especially if someone's got quite a long mortgage and they're looking to clear it quicker. However, Ed, our reporter, as you said, has dug into this, and there is a bit of a snag in that many mortgage lenders won't actually let you structure your direct debits in that way. Okay. So we spoke to some of them. We spoke to Santander, Nationwide, Barclays. They all said that they don't allow customers to do that. You have to pay one single monthly direct debit. Halifax says that while it's possible, it'd be a complicated combination of changing the direct debit date and amount, plus setting up a standing order for the other payments. So it's something that, even if your lender does allow you to do it, it sounds like it's going to be a nightmare. That sentence I just said sounds like something I would not want to get involved with doing. Mm-hmm. However, there is still a way that borrowers can do this, even if their bank doesn't let them to have two direct debits a month, which is basically making overpayments. So you would add up, say, for that, to get that extra kind of 13th month payment, just add up all your kind of monthly payments, work out what an extra one would be, and then just split it across the 12 months in the year, and then make a voluntary overpayment of 1/12 of a mortgage payment every single month, and you'll still get the same effect. So it's, you know, actually doing it in this bi-weekly way might be a bit of a headache, but you can still get the same effect by simply overpaying a bit every month and still save that amount.
All right then, thank you very much, Helen. Right, £100 global market investment made in the week of the first COVID-19 lockdown back in March 2020. would now be worth £230. The start of the pandemic was unsurprisingly accompanied by a stock market slump, and the size of the reward demonstrates the recovery since those lows, obviously. The stay-at-home order turned out to have signalled a rare buying opportunity for investors. So this is Money Spoke to Tom Stevenson, Investment Director at Fidelity International, to get his six key takeaways from investment trends since the pandemic. Simon, just explain, what was the thinking behind this piece firstly?
It was a look at what you can learn, really. I mean, we're now in a position where we're 5 years on from the kind of start of the pandemic, which, you know, it's quite a long time, isn't it?
Wow,
really?
Yeah.
Doesn't seem like that long ago.
No.
I remember 5 years ago, late January, before it all properly really kicked off, when it was just like a bit of stuff in China.
Mm-hmm.
I remember two things. I remember doing an investing show, and Richard Hunter, who I was doing it with, saying to me, maybe we should talk about this this thing in China, because like it sounds like it might be quite a big thing. I remember thinking, ah, it doesn't sound that big. But also, it's my wife's birthday near the end of January, and we had a couple of friends over for dinner. And they were meant to be going to Shanghai the following week. My friend was meant to be going there for work, and my other friend, who is her boyfriend, he was going to go out there as well. And my other friend was like, you sure you want to go there at the moment? And they're like, well, I don't know, you know. And then the next week they got their flights cancelled. But even then, we didn't really realise what was coming up.
No.
So you have to go to actually more like to kind of the start of March and then into the middle of March for it really to kick off. But interestingly, if you do look back, okay, there are some lessons you can learn. Like, first of all, which is that the stock market fell in advance of those lockdowns. Ironically, pretty much the moment that lockdown was announced was the time to buy, because that was the point at which the market started to rebound, having crashed. So first lesson here, contrarian opportunities require courage and timing. Tom points out global shares dropped 33% in early 2020, but they more than doubled in value, you know, within 5 years. To benefit, however, would have required perfect timing. It would have required basically going, all right, fine, we're going into lockdown, I'm buying. Now, to give an example of this, I've always said, right, you know, stock markets don't crash by like 30% that often. And I was always like, next time the market crashes by 30%, I am going all in. I didn't do that. The market crashed by 30%, and it was like, oh yeah, but this does seem really bad. You know, this does, I mean, it did seem really bad, didn't it? I was like, oh, I don't know, maybe I'll wait. Yeah, unprecedented was the word of the month, wasn't it, in March 2020?
It was.
It was used an unprecedented amount of times. And so, yeah, I didn't buy in. And then the market rebounded quite strong. And I thought, oh, yeah, but this is a flash in the pan. It's going to crash again after this. I'll wait till it goes back down again. And I missed out. I missed my market fell by 30%, and I'm going to, you know, go as much all in as I possibly dare moment. And yeah, it's cost me quite a lot of money, I guess, really, over the long term. But you know, if you're going to be a contrarian, you've got to be brave and bold.
Yeah.
And maybe then also, but then, you know, we'll come on to a lesson in a minute about how it could be helped, which is that maybe you drip feed your money in. Okay, I'm going to jump forward actually to lesson number five, which is steady investing can smooth the ride. So what I should have done is gone, no, I'm not going to go all in, but actually it's 30% down now. I've got a sum of money and I'm going to invest it over, say, you know, once a month, each month for 6 months, or once a month, each month for a year kind of thing. Lesson two, time heals market wounds. You know, it did underscore the long-term resilience of the stock market, and how, you know, companies that can go out and make money will keep driving returns up, putting money towards productive use. And we've seen, you know, a huge tech boom off the back of it that we just talked about. Lesson three, it's not easy to pick winners. Those early stay-at-home favorites, the companies that absolutely rocketed, Peloton, Zoom, for you know, that kind of thing. Peloton surged fivefold in 2020. It has since plummeted to a third of its January 2020 value. Zoom has delivered no net returns over the same period, which actually is amazing when you think about it. How many more people now use Zoom than did back then? And it's not actually delivered any stock market returns over that period. It has done if you bought it at the right point and then sold out at the right point, but if you just held on, you haven't done well. Whereas some other companies that were like absolutely beaten down have had big, big resurgences. British Airways owner IAG, Rolls-Royce, engine maker, BP at one point, you know, things like that. If you caught those at the right time, very much old economy stocks, you would have made quite a lot of money. Diversification has proved a mixed blessing. So diversification matters, but actually the traditional 60-40 portfolio of shares and bonds hasn't really delivered as well as it could have done. But the diversification in terms of spreading your money around the world in investing has paid off. So for example, buying the global market, you know, it might have been driven by the US, but there were times when, you know, holding the global market rather than just the US would have done you a favor. For example, when we saw the US market slump in 2022, we've already done steady investing can smooth the ride. And lesson six, stay on course to achieve your long-term financial goals. Tom says the years since the pandemic have been a roller coaster for investors, demonstrating the importance of patience, diversification, and disciplined investing. You can't predict market movements. Past performance is not a reliable indicator of future returns, but staying invested, maintaining your long-term plans, rather than chopping and changing constantly, would have absolutely been the best course of action.
Which sounds very much sort of like good old-fashioned investing advice, sort of almost whatever the weather, no?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, I mean, it is. It's, you know, it's the weather. Markets are rocketing up or crashing down. It's the kind of keep a cool head. Don't, react in a fit of passion or emotion or anything like that. And just keep going. Think long term, because ultimately for most people, they're going to be investing for decades to come. And if you look back, you know, even at the biggest market crashes on a stock market chart, you know, they tend to look, you know, more like a bit of a blip in the rearview mirror.
All right then. Right. Finally, in a win for This Is Money reporting, Nectar will allow customers to lock spending on their accounts. It comes, of course, after the team revealed customers' concerns that they were being defrauded of millions of points. In fact, in the past year, 12.5 million Nectar points worth nearly £63,000 had been stolen from readers. At the start of February, Nectar introduced a spend lock. And Helen, you got the information on this as a tip-off from a listener to the podcast.
Yeah, so this is a great example of when our readers get in touch and it sort of sparks, or listeners, sorry, get in touch and it sparks... Yes, but sparks a story for us. So this is the Nectar card story that we've been talking about for several weeks. Millions of people are getting their Nectar points stolen by scammers who managed to get hold of essentially their sort of Nectar barcode and absolutely rinse their accounts. So our reporter, Anghara Carrick, has been looking into this. And the issue we've sort of come against is, what? Why can't Sainsbury's stop this? Because this isn't really happening with Tesco club cards or, Boots Advantage cards or any other kind of reward cards. That, you know, what? Why can't Nectar do anything to stop this? So this person has got in touch with us. This is a listener to the podcast, and they've told us that they were on their Nectar app and they've noticed a new feature, which is a lock feature, enabling you to lock your Nectar card so that the points can't be spent until you unlock it and choose to spend them. So I actually went on the app today and tried to find it. It's under the settings. For me, it actually didn't work. I just couldn't click on the button where it said lock. So I don't know why it was going there. Maybe that's just an issue with me. But it seems like Sainsbury's has seen our story, seen what's happened, and decided to take action. So do let us know if you've tried this, if it works, if your points are still being stolen. But it seems like some sort of positive progress has been made on this. So a good tip off.
Nothing. I've got nothing on mine under settings. I don't have anything. I don't have one.
Yeah, maybe they're just...
Sorry about that.
I ruined
the story, but I've not got anything like that.
Yeah, so Sainsbury's hasn't actually formally announced that they're doing this yet. So I think maybe we've just kind of caught them mid rolling it
beta
out.
Beta testing, yeah.
But it does seem like something that that everyone should hopefully be able to access soon. So yeah, they confirmed to us that they have recently introduced it, but maybe they weren't... quite finished yet when our eagle-eyed listener got in touch.
Fingers crossed. Right, Simon, we've got a mug. We're going to give it away. Who are we going to give it away? Reader question of the week.
Okay, the reader question of the week this week comes from Colin in Liverpool. And it's a long one, so I'm going to have to paraphrase it slightly. All right. Okay, so first bit, I'll just do the Georgie bit here where I read out the bit where someone says something nice to us. After receiving some bad financial advice in the 90s, I made it my business to educate myself financially. And your weekly podcast has been a big part of that journey.
Oh, there you go. Colin.
Anyway,
thanks.
This is the question.
Nice.
Right, so he said, me and a good friend, both in our mid-60s, he took financial advice, so his friend, and de-risked his pension over the last 4 years and lost a lot of money after being advised by bonds by his financial advisor, which plummeted in the rising interest rate regime. So this is to do with, like, as you're approaching retirement, the traditional advice has been to de-risk, lower your risk, go more into bonds, less into shares, so you can protect it, so you can then use that pot to then buy your retirement income. Now, Colin said, I did the opposite, went down the self-invested personal pension road and invested in reputable global trackers and some big global funds. He's done very well and he's very happy. He said, however, I have begun to lower my risk by buying some bonds. The reason being, he said, that I can buy government gilts directly, delivering 4.5% interest. I've done this and I'm going to hold them to maturity. So the key there is by holding them to maturity, he knows exactly the return he's going to get. He's not going to suffer from that fluctuation in the value of bonds, which happens when you have tends to happen when you have a bond fund. In addition to this, I've also bought bonds in the likes of Tesco, Barclays and HSBC. Reason being, the bonds prices have fallen back to the issuing price and they're paying coupons of 5 to 7%, which mature over the next 5 to 7 years. I don't think they'll go bust. So he said, I've now got a portfolio of 70% shares, 30% very cheap bonds. So his question is, his friend's financial advisor is now advising his friend to buy an annuity. But he says, why would you do that when you could just buy gilts directly, like he has, and hold them, paying you 4.5% a year, and then you get to keep hold of your money, whereas with an annuity, you lose, you know, you buy the annuity, it pays you out an income for the rest of your life, and then the money's gone. So the reason is that an annuity will generally pay you more. And that's because if you look at the annuities paying a similar rate to the gilts, they'll usually have some other element attached. For example, it might be that when the person who's bought the annuity dies, their surviving partner gets an income, or it might be that the income goes up with inflation or other things. The annuity will generally pay you more. The other thing that you've got to remember is that, yes, what you've done has paid off and you've done very well off the back of it. And actually, if you can buy these bonds and hold them, that's great. But you've got to keep on top of that. And it's your responsibility to keep buying the bonds, keep getting the bonds that will pay you that income. And you are at the mercy, potentially, of interest rates. Because unless you can buy a bond that's going to last for the next 30 years, you're not guaranteeing your income for retirement. You're probably only buying a gilt that lasts for 5 years. You're guaranteeing your income for the next 5 years. And in 5 years' time, if gilt yields have gone down, your income is going to go down. And this is the same thing with, for example, saying, oh, I've just invested in a income investment trust, which tends to pay, you know, very, very stable and rising income. Is that's great, but you are at the mercy of the markets. And you're also, going back to what we were talking about before, you're at the mercy of your own decisions. Is that, are you absolutely 100% certain that you can stick the course on this, make the right decisions at the right times, not panic when the market sinks and all those other things? You know, if you buy the global funds and they go in your favor, absolutely brilliant. But if they'd gone against you, what would you have done then? And that's where the financial advice comes in, and why the financial advisor would have advised someone to de-risk. It's why the financial advisor will be saying buy an annuity, because the financial advisor will have spoken to your friend, asked lots of questions. Your friend has probably said that something that they would really value is a guaranteed income for the rest of their life, and so on. And that's where the advice comes in versus the kind of doing it yourself. And whilst there are examples, you know, and bravo, Colin, right, for doing all of this stuff yourself, listening to the podcast, educating yourself financially and all that kind of stuff. And you've done really, really, really well.
And now he's got a mug.
Yeah, and now you've got a mug as well to go with it. But for every Colin, there'll be another... Yeah. You know, 9 people out there who didn't do all the right things, made a mistake, made a couple of bad decisions, freaked out when markets crashed or whatever like that, and ended up costing themselves a load of money. Whereas the advantages of, you know, professional financial advice and financial planners is they're there to stop you doing that.
Quite. All right, and finally, Simon, your stat of the week.
My stat of the week is, according to a survey by Royal London of 4,000 adults with a pension, the amount that they would typically want to retire on is...
1 million.
They were more realistic than that.
Oh, sorry. Okay.
Well, actually, I mean, in terms of the size of the pension...
Yeah.
Then, yeah. But in terms of the annual income... 48,900 pounds.
Is that a couple or is that single or didn't go into detail?
They didn't go into that detail. But yeah, so that's 48,900 pounds a year is the amount of money that most people would like to retire on, according to this survey, which includes a full state pension, which is worth around 11,500 pounds at today's rate. And in order to get that, Royal London calculates that in addition to your full state pension, you would need to have built a pension pot worth £696,000 at the point that you retire.
All right, then. All right, that is it. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon.
You can email us at podcast@thisismoney.co.uk. Send us your question for question of the week and you will win a mug. Mugs are on the way to our winners, and so yeah, send in your question, stick question in the subject line and we will search it out. You can also tell us anything interesting that you want to tell us. You can tweet us, X us, whatever you want to call it, at This Is Money, and you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcasts to find all podcasts past and join in the debate in reader comments.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
Take control of your finances with Charles Stanley Direct. Invest, save, coach, or plan. Using technology where it's helpful and people where it matters. Our website and app make trading cost-effective and flexible. But we're more than just an online investment service. We're here for you regardless of your financial needs or if your life takes an unexpected turn. Your finances, your way. Take control today with Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.